Good morning, everybody. My contact information is on these slides, and you'll have these available on the website as well. So you can download those, and you'll have my contact information there, of course. If you want to come up afterwards and ask some sidebar questions, I'll be sticking around for a little bit for that as well. A couple of quick notes, especially if you'll be reading these later on. First thing is that I'm going to use some terms interchangeably, I2P2, which is injury and illness prevention programs, safety programs, all these sorts of terms. I'm going to be using them interchangeably. Don't think that for the purposes of this presentation that there's some sort of difference with those. It's just that different stakeholders or different industries and so forth have kind of adopted certain language. The other thing is that with these slides, when you get them, when you download them from the website, or if you email me, I'd be happy to email it back to you. There'll be some embedded links throughout the presentation. You'll see them highlighted and underlined. If you click on those, it'll give you additional information on that particular topic. So that's it'll be an additional resource for you. So again, I wanted to make this as useful for you as possible as far as being a reference document in the future. So for today, what I was going to do was give a brief overview of OSHA, how it's structured, how it came about, and that kind of thing. We'll get into some of the economics of safety, some of the aspects of safety from costs and things of that sort. We'll get into the legal requirements, what are actually legally required within the brewing industry and with other industries as well, but what's legally required for safety and health. We'll go over OSHA's views, if you will, on what makes an effective safety and health program, and we'll walk through some of those so you can get an idea of from a management perspective on how some of these programs should be implemented. And then we'll get into some of the very specific issues that are faced that we've seen throughout the brewing industry and that you're all facing. And of course, we'll have the Q&A. So OSHA, that's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It's housed out of the Department of Labor. It came about through what's called the OSH Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. And that's a piece of legislation that came out of Congress that created OSHA, the agency, and it also created a couple of other agencies or other entities. It created an agency out of the Center for Disease Control called NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and they are the research arm. They do a lot of the background research for OSHA, you know, all the lab rat testing and that kind of thing, and a lot of the technical research that supports OSHA when it's thinking about doing a new rulemaking or on any other host of emerging issues. And it also created a commission called the OSHRC, the OSH Review Commission. And you could think of that as a specialized court system for OSHA. So obviously, one of the things that when the act was made, it gave OSHA the mission to assure the safety and health of the workplace and those working in those in industry. And when OSHA issues a citation, which they're allowed to do under the Act, they can set requirements, they can enforce the requirements, and so forth. Instead of clogging, if you will, the court system, they created this commission that when an employer has been cited and they want to appeal the citation, it's called a contest, it would go through this commission, which specializes specifically on workplace safety and health. And then from there, depending on the case, it can go into the federal court system and all the way up into the Supreme Court. There's a number of cases that have gone all the way up to the Supreme Court out of OSHA, and that becomes effectively law. The last one was about a month ago on a particular issue related to what's called letters of interpretation. I won't get into that. It's not going to be something that's overly relevant for the purposes of today, but that's the legal background of how it works. OSHA is in about 8 million different workplaces across the country, and they pretty much cover everybody. There's a few industries that are exempt that are covered by other safety-related regulators, transportation, pipelines, ag, and some others. But as far as brewing is concerned, it does fall within the jurisdiction of OSHA. And I'll get a little bit into the differences of OSHA. There's something called state plan states and federal. When the OSH Act was created, Congress basically said to the states, you can either do it yourselves and create your own occupational safety and health set of requirements and so forth, or you can relinquish that responsibility to us, the federal government, and we'll do it and enforce it. However, if the states do it themselves, they must meet at a minimum what the federal requirements are. But in those states, Oregon, Washington, California, Michigan, you'll see the list here at the bottom. If you're in any of those states, you'll be falling under the state plan OSHA. And there could be, in many of those states, there's requirements above and beyond what the federal requirements are. And one of those requirements in many of those states is having written safety and health programs and training and so forth for the employees. And we'll get into some of those here. It's broken out into 10 regions. You can see where your region is, and then they'll you'll fall under that region. Oh, that's cute. Each one is its own management structure in the regions. They all report into Washington, D.C. for the federal OSHA. That's how it's structured. From an inspection standpoint and from an enforcement standpoint, inspections are broken out into the different types of inspections, anything from imminent danger, that's pretty much what's self-explanatory. It's somebody can get seriously hurt in very short order, accidents, complaints, referrals. I won't get into too much detail, but those are the different types of inspections. I have an asterisk on complaint because I looked at a lot of the statistics for the brewing industry specifically, and that is the number one, by far the number one method that's the number one reason why an OSHA compliance officer may be knocking on your doors through an employee complaint. And just a quick comment about that is that within the OSH Act, the employees do have a right to contact OSHA and say, hey, I'm concerned about a safety issue. And then OSHA will follow up depending on the type of complaint. But one thing is that always recommend is not to try to find out who it is and any sort of reprisals or anything, because there's also some whistleblower protection that's involved as well. So what I always advise is that if you are ever visited by OSHA based on a complaint, to use it as an opportunity to understand that somebody views a condition in the workplace that's serious enough that they had to contact OSHA, and use it as an opportunity to move forward with your safety programs and compliance and try to improve in that regard. So those are the types of inspections. You have types of violations. At the end of the day, OSHA may or may not issue a citation. When they issue a citation with a violation, it'll be classified with, you can think of it as a severity, ranging from willful down to other than serious. Other than serious can be something, as simple as, you didn't have an OSHA poster up, and that might be a couple $100 or something like that, something relatively minor, all the way up to willful. And if there's an accident involving a fatality and there's a willful violation associated that led to the cause of that, OSHA has the discretion to pursue criminal investigation, in which case it would go over to DOJ. Those are very rare and very specialized cases. But the willfuls can typically, what they'll do is there'll be a fine of a penalty of $70,000. Repeats the same. When they issue citation, they will require a deadline by which you have to correct that problem. And if you don't meet that deadline, then it becomes a $7,000 a day. So when you read headlines and you hear of someone getting $1 million penalty, $5 million penalty, whatever the case might be, what they've done is that they've issued willfuls, and they've instituted something called the egregious policy, which means that they'll cite every single instance that issue occurred and cite that $70,000, and that's how they ratchet it up. That's what they'll use if they really want to go after somebody who they feel is a bad actor. There's nobody, I checked in the brewing industry, there's nobody that I've been able to find that's been in, put into this, what's called the SVET program, which is OSHA's bad actor list. It's a severe violator enforcement program. So anybody that gets a citation of more than $100,000, or if it meets a couple other criteria, they get placed into that, and it's sort of like the Roach Motel. You check in, but you can't check out. It's something that that OSHA basically treats that as a bad actor list, and they put a lot of extra attention, if you will, on those employers. I haven't seen anything nearly like that in the brewing industry, which is good. as far as the economics of safety, obviously there's wide-ranging benefits. There's costs associated with not having good performance, safety performance, and there's benefits to having good safety performance. Reputation is a big one. I've gotten phone calls from companies saying, "Hey, we entered into the SVET program, and OSHA is issuing all these press releases, and it's affecting our business. Our insurance carrier's dropping us. Our business situation. You know, their customers are starting to reevaluate the contracts with us, things of that sort, because they don't want to have the bleed on effects, if you will, with the reputation. So there are some reputational risks. Obviously, there's risks with penalties, product quality. If you're a small brewer and someone gets hurt and they're out for a couple months, and that brewer, that person that got hurt is central to the brewing process, is your head brewer or whatever the case might be, that could affect your production and quality as well. And there's obviously organizational impacts, morale, loyalty, things of that sort. We'll get a little bit into that a little later. But there's a lot of companies that have really instituted effective safety and health programs that have used it literally as a competitive advantage, where they've gone out. You see this in a lot of different industries. One that really comes to mind is in construction, where they will compete on bidding contracts based on safety records. And if they don't meet certain thresholds, they literally won't be able to compete on that particular project. But within brewing, there's a lot of headwinds associated with the costs of injuries. But anyway, many companies are using this as safety programs as a competitive advantage, also for recruiting and hiring and retaining employees and maintaining a low workforce turnover. So I showed a version of the slide last year. If you had an opportunity to sit through the presentation last year, I gave a more of a broader OSHA overview. This is a modified version of that, where I went back and I looked at the insurance industry costs. So this is from Liberty Mutual, does a safety index every year. This one's from 2011. I think they're about to release the data from 2012. But it's overall all industries. What are the associated costs with workplace injuries? And you know, they found that between Liberty Mutual and the National Safety Council, where I assembled this data, a fatality typically costs about 1 point. Aside from the personal loss, from an injury cost perspective, can be up to an average of 1.4 million. Disabling injury about 60,000. A workers' comp about 11,000. And an OSHA recordable being about an $8,000 injury. That would be a case where they have somebody breaks a bone in their foot or breaks a finger, or gets a cut requiring stitches, things of that sort. According to the insurance industry, the National Safety Council, the average cost for that is about $8,000. So I took that data and I looked at, okay, well, what is the injury and illness rate, experience rate in the industry? And within brewing, it's about 5.5 cases per 100 employees. What that means is if you're a brewer and you have 100 employees, on average, there'll be about 5.5 injuries per year. And if you multiply that by the $8,000 average, you get a good cost number. And if you assume, I went further, peeled the onion back further, if you will, and said, okay, well, if there's a 5% margin, to make up for the cost of those injuries from a profit margin perspective, it would take about almost $900,000 in increased sales to counteract the headwind or the costs that came out through the back door, if you will, on injuries and not having effective safety and health programs and practices in the workplace. So it's very interesting data. I encourage you to look at these, and you'll see these some of the issues later on that that OSHA is really looking at and what's causing a number of the injuries. So from a citation or enforcement, I went and I looked at overall in the private sector, what does OSHA find when they come in and do an inspection? And you'll see the issues listed in rank order of the average penalty amount. So for machine guarding, this would be like if you have a compressor with a fan belt or something like that and the guards are off, or the bottling line, if you don't have the guards on the bottling equipment, OSHA, on average, nationally, will issue a penalty of about $4,000 on that. And you'll see them listed all the way down to hazard communication. Again, these are the ones that are most commonly cited in all industries. Within brewing itself, the ones that really come up a lot are going to be the lockout, tagout is a big one, and confined space is another area that's going to be a major concern for OSHA. And then on the bottom, I also did some more research for you all on the brewing industry. And on average, in an inspection, there'll be about $13,000. If OSHA knocks on the door, you could expect about a $13,000 penalty. Again, that's if you take the total amount of penalties that they've assessed within the industry, and you divide it by the number of inspections within the industry, you'll come up with that average. And also about 3.6 violations, and that'll give you the average penalty amount for the penalties. We'll get into these in future slides, but the issues in my mind that if you're a brewer and you're growing and you really need to focus on, obviously all of them, but the ones that would really keep me up at night is going to be confined space and lockout, tagout. It could be the two that jump up to the very top. Obviously, all these other issues are very important. But I'm just curious. Yesterday there was a CO2, carbon dioxide, everything you ever wanted to know. I'm curious if anyone attended that, a number of you folks. I highly encourage, it was a very good presentation done by, I think his name was David, on the safety committee. I highly encourage everyone to look at that, and you'll see why in a few minutes. But that's probably the number one issue, if I was a brewer, that would literally keep me up at night worrying about that particular issue. So went and looked at the injury rates in the brewing industry and compared it to the overall private sector. You'll see in yellow that is the private sector, with the dark line being the brewery industry. And I charted over the last, I guess it's 12 years or 10 years, something like that. I can't see that over there, but I think it's over the last 10 years. The trends of the injury rates from a total recordable, that would be a finger cuts that needed stitches, or a broken bone, something like that. The total injuries, you can see the trends there. And then a DART case it stands for days away, restricted or transferred. That is, someone got hurt and they couldn't come to work for a period of time, or they had to get reassigned to a different task because they couldn't perform the task that they're normally assigned due to the injury. And you'll see the trends there. And you'll see over the last few years, there's actually been an uptick, a deviation between the brewing industry and the overall private sector. And that's where you see now, you see on the previous slide, it was 5.5 versus 3.5, I think it was, for overall private sector. So you'll see the little bit of the uptrend there in the last few years. And that's something that hopefully through the safety committee and others that can help brewers recognize what's causing those and help implement measures to mitigate those. So that's the economics of it. I'll get into some of the safety and health requirements. This is sort of a laundry list of all the states that have workplace requirements in some shape or form related to safety. Some of them may be wage and hour, not necessarily OSHA. It wouldn't be OSHA that's going to be enforcing it. It'd be a wage and hour or some other type of agency. And if you see a star by the name of the state, that means that it's operating under a state plan, and it'll be California OSHA that comes in to visit you, or Connecticut or Michigan, and so forth. The ones where there's a lot of activity with OSHA and brewers in particular. I mean, there's inspections are nationwide, but where you see a lot of inspections, from what I've seen from the data, is going to be California, Oregon, and Washington State, and Michigan. So if you're in those states, those state plans are very engaged with the industry, if you will, on inspections. So I encourage, if you're in one of those states, I encourage you to click on those links, and you can learn a little bit more about what the specific requirements are in that particular state. So for existing safety and health programs, there's a number of programs that OSHA has, a number of standards that OSHA has issued where they require a written program or some sort of program that's implemented and training provided to the employees. LOTO, that stands for lockout tagout. You could use that whenever, if you have to work on a piece of equipment that has moving parts, to require lockout and tagout to make sure that the machinery doesn't start on you while you're working on it. So there's going to be a lockout tagout. PRCS is a permit required confined space. OSHA does require that you evaluate the workplace to determine what confined spaces you have, and if any of them meet permit required. And if it does, then there are some things you can do to minimize the regulatory compliance burden through alternate entries and so forth. And we'll get into that when the slide comes up. But that's a very important program. HAZCOM, hazardous communication. We'll get into that. Bloodborne, you see the list there. Those are all required by OSHA for the employer to have a program that's implemented and up and running. A lot of state plans I talked about before will have additional requirements that will require an overall safety and health program that's implemented. So you should be aware of those. I know Oregon, for example, we're in Oregon. Oregon has such requirements, as does some of the others. And a lot of times what will happen in the course of a citation, you can go through a settlement agreement with OSHA, and you can negotiate that. Sometimes OSHA will say, well, we'll reduce the penalty amounts, or we'll take you off of SVAP, or whatever the case might be, depending on what the case is. If you implement safety and health programs that are above and beyond, if you will, what may be required with just these. You have other safety and health programs implemented that they can include that as part of the settlement agreement, and then that'll obviously be required. There's some other resources here. ANSI Z10, it's a consensus standard. The overall safety and health program, how to structure one, how to implement one, ISO 45001, voluntary protection program, and then OSHA issued in 1989 a set of guidelines on how to write and implement safety and health programs in the workplace. Those are all links you can go and you can learn more. Just a quick comment on voluntary protection program. That's basically OSHA's recognition program that they've gone in, they've done a review of the facility, and they've determined that the safety and health management systems that have been implemented and the training and everything is exemplary. I think there's one brewer that's in VPP, and I can't remember the name of it. I want to say it's Toll Brothers or something. I can't remember. I have to look it up. But anyway, that's sort of the Malcolm Baldrige Award, if you will, from OSHA, saying that that workplace has an exceptional safety and health program. So the OSHA's safety programs, how does OSHA view safety programs? What they've done, and there's tons of research out there on safety and health performance and programs and what makes a good program and all these kinds of things. OSHA's basically boiled it down into what they call the six principles or six elements of a program. The first two are critically important. It's management leadership and employee participation. You have to have both. It has to be a top-down and a bottom-up. If you don't have both kind of working together and kind of coalescing, it's going to be very difficult to implement an effective safety and health program. So management has to demonstrate commitment. They have to demonstrate that they expect the workplace to be safe and implement all the safety requirements and training and incorporate safety metrics into performance reviews and all those kinds of things, and basically promote the importance of safety on the site and reward it and recognize it. On the employee side, obviously it's the employees that on the quote unquote front lines doing the daily tasks that are often the ones that are exposed to such hazards. It's important for them to be participating in the program because they're the ones that know what's, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road, if you will. So it's important to get their solicit their input, and there's very good methods for doing that, which I'll get into. So that's very important. Identification of hazards and assessing those hazards. There's some that are required by OSHA, for example, PPE, personal protective equipment, that you have to assess what hazards are in the workplace and how you could address those hazards. And it requires that you go through sort of a risk assessment process to accomplish that. Hazard prevention and control. If you look at the presentation from yesterday, Dave did a really good job of walking through the pyramid structure of controls for safety, where the first thing you want to do is eliminate the hazard. You want to substitute away from it if you can. Engineering controls, work practices or administrative controls, and then lastly, sort of like as the Alamo, would be PPE. You never want to have to rely on PPE to be as your primary source of protection for employee. You always want to have that as the Alamo, if you will. But anyway, the hazard prevention and control and identifying is also obviously very important. You have to know where the hazards are and what are you going to do to control those. So yesterday, Dave went through a really good process of for the CO2 in particular, talking about the exhaust fans and things of that sort. Very important. Education and training is obviously very important. The employees have to know what the hazards are. They have to know how to protect. They have to know how to protect themselves, and they have to be trained on recognizing where there may be an issue. And then program evaluation and continuous improvement. That's where the process of an injury that happens, going in and doing an accident investigation, figure out exactly what happened, what were the root causes, and what changes could be made either in work procedure or equipment or PPE or whatever the case might be, depending on the case, to prevent that from happening again. And if it does happen again, to minimize the severity of what that incident is. And a lot of that is done through OSHA record keeping. You can do a lot of that through OSHA record keeping, for example, as well, where you can track what injuries have occurred, and you do the accident investigation, and you do process improvements from there. And then there's a link at the bottom on OSHA I2P2. Again, it's injury illness prevention programs, where you can get additional information on how OSHA views each one of these elements, and you can learn a little bit more about each one of these. It's a pretty robust process, and it's one that has been proven time and time again through a lot of research, especially out of OSHA and academics and so forth, that have coalesced on these basic principles to ensure a safe workplace. So when you go and you actually implement the workplaces, the safety, obviously one brewery is not going to be the same as the other. There's a lot of similarities. But some breweries are, you know, you might be a nano brewery or a micro brewery, and another one might be a rather large one. You may have different types of issues that are being faced in that particular brewery. So just recognize that you may have some issues that another brewery may not. And that's part of the whole purpose of having these types of forums and so forth, that you can meet each other and discuss some of these issues, and through the safety committee as well, bringing some of these to light. Underscoring what some of these issues are, some of the differences, and how you may be able to address or accommodate some sort of resolution for those types of issues. Lastly, you know, we always recommend that if you do engage with outside parties, consultants, or anybody, it's a good idea to have attorney-client privilege. It's an added layer of just-in-case insurance, if you will, to protect any of the information that you've collected and gathered and working on, especially if it's around the areas of audits and things of that sort. We do that with a lot of our clients, where we'll provide it free of charge, you know, attorney-client privilege. And it just gives that extra layer of protection that, you know, that OSHA's not going to get access to this information. Because at the end of the day, we want the site to be safe. So how do you know if you have a safe working and safe environment? You know, I was talking about research, a lot of research that shows that when the employees are engaged, well-trained, that there's a lot of respect, if you will, and a lot of collaboration between management and workers, employees, and so forth, That translates into employees really caring about what they're doing and going above and beyond and doing what they're going to do, and then also take the extra steps to make sure that they're doing it right. And then, of course, accomplish what they're going to what they're set out to do, and they're going to meet what their obligations are. And then you may have situations where that may not be the case, and you have what amounts to maybe perhaps some disgruntled employees or whatnot that will go out of their way and not perform some of their tasks to the way that they perhaps should. And there's a lot of research on these that has been conducted that kind of shows that safety and health does play into this. In fact, there was a lot of research in Australia where they looked at a lot of data, and they found that within industries, those that were performing at the higher end, if you will, their stock price was about 40% higher than those that were on the bottom right. So it does have a bottom line impact on the value of a business as well, implementing some of these, and it's some pretty interesting research. So the brewery safety issues, these are going to be some of the ones that obviously you guys are faced with on a day in and day out basis. There's all sorts of issues that come up. Not all of these necessarily obviously require written programs necessarily, but these are all issues that we found in a brewery that should be addressed in some way, shape, or form. I'm going to go through some of those top five there in the top left. I'm going to go through a couple slides on one or two slides on each one of those. But these are all issue areas that you want to make sure that you have, effective programs for. Just because I don't talk about them here doesn't mean that they're not important, like forklifts and ergonomics and some of these others. So I'm going to go through the contractor and temporary worker safety, the permit required confined space, lockout, tagout, HAZCOM, and keg safety, because these are issues that have seemed to come up quite a bit in the breweries. So temporary workers and contractors, what's the difference? A contractor will be a firm that you hire, such as an electrician firm, a HVAC firm, some sort of a maintenance company that you may have come in and do some work. Those are contractors. And I'll make some comments about that in a second, how you may want to incorporate some safety management practices with those that you have coming on site. The other one is temporary workers. These will be the employees that you may hire on a seasonal basis to come in. You may hire anywhere from five of them perhaps up to maybe 100 of them at different breweries, different hiring needs from a temporary worker standpoint. But you're hiring in to come in as surge labor, if you will. And you're doing their day-to-day management and supervising and telling them what the tasks that they're supposed to do and so forth. From an OSHA perspective, those employees that you bring on site that are temporary workers, they may only be there for 2 days and you never see them again. From an OSHA perspective, it doesn't matter. OSHA views those employees as your employees. So they'll have to do some sort of awareness training and so forth for those to make sure that they understand what sort of PPE they may need. Typically, those types of employees are assigned to low-risk jobs, but if you have them assigned to higher-risk ones, they're going to need a certain level of training. So as I said, for a temporary worker, OSHA will, that's a very hot topic right now with OSHA, and they will come out, and if they see that it's a standard practice to bring in temporary workers, they will include that as part of their inspection scope. With terms of contractors, an important concept is something called the multi-employer enforcement policy. And basically what this means is, let's just say you're a brewer and you have a contractor that's coming in to install a new fermenter or do some electrical work, whatever the case might be. And you have no specialized, there's nobody in your company that does fermentation installation, and that's why you hire a contractor to come in and install that stuff. If one of those employees, one of those contractors gets injured and it triggers an OSHA inspection, what will happen when the compliance officer comes out is that when they see a violation, they're going to cite a violation. The next part of the process in the enforcement cycle is determine, well, who gets that violation? Is it company A, B, C, or D? And they will go through a process of determining these four different types of employers: controlling employer, creating, exposing, and correcting. So the controlling employer in the brewing industry will be the brewer itself. And OSHA will look and see, okay, who's the controlling employer? If you have a contractor that comes on site, and they'll say, well, the brewer is obviously a controlling employer. They have control of the facility. They control who comes in and out. And that, by virtue of being a controlling employer, you can be cited for something that a contractor does. I'm not saying it always happens, but it's very common. The creating employer is to be the employer that physically creates the hazard. And then exposing employers would be the one that has employees that are self-explanatory exposed to that hazard. So, for example, if you have an electrician contractor that comes on site and is doing some work and forgets to lock and tag something out on a piece of equipment or something, and one of your employees gets hurt, the electrical contractor will be the creating employer and potentially could be cited. But then also the brewer could be cited because they are a creating employer as well as the controlling employer. So it gets pretty complicated. It's highly nuanced. The bottom line is that there are some things you can do to protect yourselves, making sure that the contractors are reputable and good safety practices and so forth. My point with this is you can't just set and forget with the contractors. Don't just assume because you hired a contractor, it's not my problem anymore. They're going to fix it. From an OSHA perspective, a lot of the responsibility onus is still going to be placed on you as well. But as I said, there are some ways to minimize that risk through affirmative defense. But anyway, I won't get into that for here. And then also, obviously, opportunities for regulatory risk reduction, but reputational risk will remain. Do your due diligence with contractors. If you know the contractor has a history of OSHA, has a history of inspections and or accidents, things of that sort, you may want to reevaluate having that contractor be a service provider to you. The next issue areas would be confined spaces. It is a major risk area within the industry. These are different cases there might be one case that's the same from that was talked about yesterday, but these are different cases where seven workers at a Corona brewery in Mexico were killed and in a confined space that had CO2. Now, the thing with CO2 in confined space that many folks don't realize is that the reason why OSHA is really, really, really engaged and really attentive to this issue is because what happens is that you have one employee that is in a situation that is exposed to CO2, and they go down. His buddy's walking by, or her buddy's walking by, and sees their friend that's down. It's like, oh, I got to go help them. So they go to help, not knowing what's going on in that area. They go down. And then the third person, and the fourth. And that's how you, with these cases, there's quite a number of famous cases that are along these lines where before it's all said and done, there may be anywhere from 3 to 5 to literally seven folks that have died because of a particular issue. So take confined spaces, and particularly those that can have CO2 exposure, very, very, very seriously. Another case, this one with Anheuser-Busch, cited for CO2 exposure. I think this one's in Houston. In the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, there was a case with Heineken where a worker was succumbed to CO2. And this one is not brewing per se. It is food-based. I think it's also out of Texas where the employer was cited for CO2. What happens during an inspection process is when OSHA determines, when a compliance officer determines they're going to go out and do an inspection, they don't just show up. I mean, they do their homework first. They're going to look up the company that they're going to go. Once they identify the company that they're going to go, there's a whole process for that I won't get into. But once they identify who they're going to go inspect, they're going to do their homework on both the employer and the industry. And so what they're going to do, first thing, is look at the employer and say, okay, who have we inspected them before? And if so, what did we find? And the reason why they do that is because they're going to look for those when they go back out there. And if they see those same issues again, it's possible that they could issue repeat violations, which is a lot higher dollar amount. But anyway, so they want to see what the history of that particular employer is. The second thing that they do is that they can look through this, just like I've done, that they can look through statistics for the industry and say, okay, as an industry as a whole, when brews are inspected, what types of issues are coming up? So I could have a special eye, if you will, on those particular issues. And one of the ones that's going to come to the top is going to be CO2 and confined space, lockout, tagout. That's why I mentioned those. Aside from being very serious issues, those are also areas that get cited a lot. And you know, think about it from a compliance standpoint, a compliance officer standpoint. They don't want to go on site, do an inspection, and then a week later there's a fatality at the site. And then the questions that everybody's going to be pointing at him is like, well, why didn't you identify that when you were on site and advise them to fix it or tell them it was an issue, whatever the case might be. So it's just something to be aware about in terms of that. That's how the process for the enforcement goes. But confined space is very important. As I said, it could be deadly. Now, there's oftentimes confined spaces and permit require confined spaces get. There's some use of using the terms interchangeably. There are some differences, important technical differences. OSHA does require that you assess what the confined spaces are in your facility. Typically, they're going to be the bright tanks. The fermenters, mash tun, the grain silos, some pits, some other breweries might have some other operations or some other equipment on site that may have confined space. But to have a confined space, it's a very clear definition within the OSHA standard. One is that it is not designed for continuous occupancy. It means when that space was designed, it was intended to be for short duration. So like when someone goes into a tank, for example, they're not intended to be in there for a long period of time. So that would be one part of the definition for a confined space. The next one is that it's large enough to bodily enter and work. So someone can physically enter that confined space. If they can't enter that confined space, obviously it's not going to be permit required, but it's not going to be an issue. And then the other last one is, and this is an and, if it meets those two plus, it's also limited entry and egress. They have to duck their head to get in. They have to crawl. They have to shimmy in sideways, whatever the case might be. They can't just walk in and walk out like they are going through a doorway. That would also make it a confined space. Where OSHA gets really concerned is when it becomes there's other hazards involved in that confined space, and they want to make sure that employers have identified what those potential hazards are and done the things that they needed to do in order to fix it. So any additional hazards, CO2 is going to be the big one. So if there's atmospheric hazards, I used to be in the construction industry, and sometimes folks would have to go into a tank and have to do some minor welding inside of a tank. You know, you're introducing a new atmospheric hazard by all those fumes welding inside of a tank. That would be an example. Those would be examples of atmospheric. And then also mechanical with rotating equipment. One of the things we recommend is that there are ways to declassify these workspaces by using alternate entry procedures, lockout, tagout, lock and tag out the hot and cold water lines going into the tank, or the rotating equipment that might be inside of the tank, things like that. You want to lock and tag those out, and then obviously you want to post signage letting the employees know that that those are confined space and that special procedures are required. Next, keg safety. There was many of you, I'm sure, have heard about the case in I think it was in Maine. I can't quite remember. It was in Northeast somewhere. Someone was purging a keg. I think it was a plastic keg and overpressurized the tank and it exploded, and there was a fatality. We've seen a number of areas where these air guns are used. Put a regulator upstream of that that's supplying that, limited down to 30 psi. That will help alleviate a lot of the hazards. And also make sure that there's the tip of the nozzle has a strain relief. You'll see like a little hole at the tip of the nozzle, so that if it's ever dead ended, like into somebody's leg or skin, the air can still escape out the sides. You want to make sure that's in place. One of the things in terms of keg safety that Oma Gang and Boulevard Brewing has done is really interesting. That they've started tracking all of their kegs, so they put barcodes on their kegs and they track when it leaves, they know where it's gone, they know when it comes back, and every so many cycles that it's gone out and back, they go through a whole process of inspection and so forth, and ones that need maintenance get maintenance or gets discarded, whatever the case might be. But it's a really good, effective way to know where the tanks are so that they could help ensure safety with related to handling the kegs. This one, actually, I should have put this slide before. This deals with confined space. If you could avoid the problem, avoid the problem. Port City Brewing had a bright tank, and they would use a standpipe that had to go in the middle of the tank sometimes. And instead of going inside the tank, reaching in and putting the standpipe in, just a real simple fix. It's not rocket science. It's, you know, $15 extension grabber thing. It's a technical term. To grab the standpipe and just put it in, that eliminates the whole need for someone having to go in, and eliminates the whole problem. So it's some of these things could be very simple fixes. Lockout, tagout. If you're doing any mechanical work on compressors, on going into the mash tun, whatever, anything where there may be rotating equipment, and so forth, you're going to want to make sure that you comply with the lockout, tagout. Put a lock on the source of the energy, whether it's a valve or electrical circuit or a disconnect, and tag it so they know who did it. There are some exceptions you take advantage of. We always tell our clients if it's a cord and plug equipment, you know, something that you like those pilot crew brew kits or whatnot, it plugs into the wall. Just have that listed in as a cord and plug piece of equipment. And just make sure that those that work with it know that the plug always has to be within arm's reach, if you will. You won't have to go through the whole lockout and tagout procedure for that. There are some ways to minimize or to lessen the burden of complying with some of these things. Hazard communication is really big with OSHA. It's the most, by far, it's typically number one, if not number two, most commonly cited. So make sure that the real easy way to comply is you make sure that the employees know where the MSDS books are and that they have easy access to them. They don't have to, you know, it's not in a locked office somewhere. They can have access to them whenever they want. And so there's some new requirements that have come out that are in the process of being active, if you will, because there's like sort of a grace period with some of the issues. But one of the ones that's required is, for example, pictograms. They understand what the different pictures are that they may see. What does a corrosivity warning look like? What does poison look like? So you want to make sure that the employees are aware of that and how to read some of the basic information on a MSDS sheet, material safety data sheet. The other one where OSHA tends to cite a lot is on labeling of secondary containers. So you have a hazardous chemical, you pour it into a smaller container. It's not labeled. It's just some sort of spray bottle. There's some things you need to do with those to make sure that you're in compliance, because a lot of times OSHA will hit you on that. And then chemical storage practices. Job safety analysis, it's a real easy way to ensure compliance. You go through a very methodical process of what's the task. So you identify all the basic steps, the high-level steps in the process, what's the potential hazard, and then what are the means to protect, what lockout, tagout, what personal protective equipment is going to be required, things of that sort. It's very simple, it's very effective, and it's one really good way to stay out of trouble. So I'll just go through a couple of quick do's and don'ts, and we'll open it up to Q&A. I've seen this basically at every brewery I've been to, and it's something that a compliance officer is going to be, if they notice it and they ask questions, they may issue citations on these. You'll see that there's, at the top of those stairways, a lot of them are just, they're open. And I know that you folks or the delivery of the grain person, whatever the case might be, climb up there and they look inside to see what the levels are. We tell folks that what we recommend is, and what a lot of the folks have done is, done alternate means of figuring out what's in that tank. So you lock out the staircase so somebody can't climb above a certain way, and then just they kind of ping along the side of the tank to determine what the level is in that tank. But having someone up way up at the top without tie off, either that or they could climb all the way up to the top, but then they're going to need to have tie off to prevent falls. This is where is this? I think this is Omegang. Ergo, this is. I know there's some vendors. I saw them yesterday. This is really good stuff to prevent lifting injuries. And plus, it's pretty fast. These are good things. A compliance officer comes in. They see these kinds of things. They're gonna know that this operator is savvy about safety, and they're gonna try to move on to something else. So that's a good practice. Here's another example where some piping materials were put in a chemical bath. That would be a no. I know it's pretty common practice, especially in buckets and things of that sort. Close the buckets, label the tank. Let folks know. Communicate. Don't make it everybody knows that that's caustic. You can't assume that. OSHA will ping you for it. And then there's another example at a different brewery where instead of having folks crawling under, in this case, real simple step over ladder to go across a bell conveyor. So just real simple things to ensure that you're in compliance. So those are just some basic examples. I guess with that, I'll open it up to, just closing thoughts. I'll let you read this later, but just train your employees. Make sure you go through your OSHA logs. I've mentioned OSHA logs. If you're not familiar with what an OSHA 300 log is, and you're more than 10 employees, part-time or full-time, see me afterwards. I can run you through it, what those are and how to comply with those. But that's one easy way. When OSHA comes in, it's typically one of the first things they ask for. And if they ask for an OSHA log and they see the person like looking at them with a blind stare saying, I have no idea, you want me to chop down a tree, I don't know what you're talking about, that's going to send a signal to the compliance officer that there could be some serious safety issues here because they're just not savvy, and if you will, on workplace safety and health requirements. So just make sure that your record-keeping logs and so forth are up to date. So I guess with that, we'll open up. You can ask any questions you want, whether it's enforcement, safety programs, compliance issues, whatever it is. Happy to answer any questions. I used to work for OSHA. I don't work for OSHA anymore, so what's said here stays here. Happy to answer any questions. Yes.
You mentioned real briefly there about number of employees. I have less than 10 employees. Obviously, we still want to have a safe workplace, but can you talk a little bit more about requirements and kind of threshold or levels? Yes. of employment that
yeah of- 10 is that. Actually, I'm really glad you brought that up. With record keeping, there's a new rule that came out effective January 1 that all employers, if you have an accident that has a hospitalization, someone's assigned to a hospital room, if there's loss of eye, amputation, or a fatality, you must notify OSHA. And that started, that change was implemented on January 1. So you have to notify OSHA if one of those things happen. There are some special exemptions for employers that are less than 10. It's partial exemption, which means you still have to notify, you could be three employees, but you still have to notify OSHA if there's a fatality or one of those kinds of injuries. What you don't have to be as robust with is the actual record-keeping 300 logs. And then there's also some other industries that have some partial exemptions. Brewing is not one of them, so I'm not going to get into that. But 10 employees, and it's full-time, part-time, it doesn't matter, and it could be just one day. If you're normally two employees, and for one day you jump up to 11, you're no longer partially exempt. You are you're fully required to comply. So I hope that answers the question.
When you were talking confined spaces, and you said, you know, one of the things is that you got to have that limited entrance egress. We've got like a two-lane keg line where it's got some guarding, you know, but it's just a door. And the guy opens it up and he can walk in. Like, would something like that be considered confined space?
Or? Well, it's going to go through those three definitions. So it's going to be one is limited egress, entrance and egress. Yeah. So if they have to duck.
But you don't. Yeah, but they, I mean, like, it's just they can just open it up and go in. They don't have to duck or like shimmy going, under or anything like that.
For example, a cooler. Okay, you open it, you open up the cooler and have to go in. That's not going to meet the requirements of that. You don't need that. That doesn't enter into the permit required confined space
right,
or anything
okay.
like that.
All right,
and for that specific one, I'd like to see like a picture or something like that, and it'd be
all
a lot
right,
easier.
Yeah, okay. But, all right. No worries. Cool.
But,
all right. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Thanks.
Hi. Could you make a quick comment about the changeover from the MSDS format to the SDS format?
Yes. There's information on this on the OSHA's website as well, and I'd be happy to email it out. If you email me, I can answer these questions in greater detail. But the format has changed. There's a common look and feel. The way it was before is that everybody kind of creates their own. Now there's something like 17 different sections that vary specifically what's going to be required in each one, and then employees are going to have to be trained on those. The best thing I can offer you is on OSHA's website. If you give me your email address or something like that, I could send that to you. But there are some requirements that's going to be met with that or required with that. For a brewer, that's not going to be typically as important. You're not producing chemicals; you're going to be receiving chemicals, so that's already going to be done for you. In many ways.
Yeah, it's just a good chance when they change over formats, it's a good time to retrain all their
Absolutely.
Employees on HAZCOM to be familiar with the new look as opposed to the old look.
Right. So January, if you haven't done it already, December 1st of last year, December 2014, the pictograms, employees are required on the pictograms. It's just it's the image, and they have to know what those different images mean. Yes.
Are there any specific OSHA requirements for tour guests beyond PPE?
I'm sorry, for?
Tour guests, OSHA requirements.
Tour guests? Tour guests are not, OSHA, that's public safety. That's not OSHA's deal, but of course you want to protect your guests. Typically, from what we've seen in breweries, possibly hearing protection. And possibly safety glasses, depending on where you take them in the tour. A lot of that is going to be where you take them through the tour. Some breweries I've been to, they will only do tours when there's no operations in place. So, you know, there's not going to be really any PPE needs. Other breweries will have the tours while there's production going in place, and that's when you want to be a lot more cognizant of it. But hearing protection and safety glasses are the first two that come to mind. And then obviously keep them clear of anywhere where there can be a hazard. You don't want them kind of walking off on their own. So hope that answers your question.
I had a question again on confined spaces. I was kind of talking to an OSHA person about this in December and was really confused about, so we have for Menners that you can't enter, but like sometimes you'll be like cleaning a ledge or something and your hand goes in the fermenter, and it was really confusing, the person saying if that was considered a confined space if your arm like goes.
Yeah, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. from a confined space standpoint, the way the OSHA reg reads is that the tip of your finger triggers it. What some folks will do, they'll have like a scoop, like they feed yeast in there and so forth. They'll tie like a rope, and they'll tether it to the arm, for example, so that if the scoop falls in, they don't have to climb in there and get it. They can just pull on the string. I don't know if you wanted to make a comment.
I was going to say, I'm with Dave. There's some nuances to this, though. I'm talking about modeling in. So it really determines the case by case basis. Really. It's just not, these things aren't always one size fits all. So if you have pictures, I was just talking to a guy from Brooklyn Brewery. So I mean, if you want, you can talk offline about it, you know, take a look at it, because there's these, it's not always just straightforward when you consider confined.
Okay, and then the question would be, on top of that, even if it is a confined space, would it, if just your arm, not your whole body, is going to go in, would it be a permit-based?
Well, so the preamble of the permit required confined space will actually be done.
Okay.
just to make sure, and we can get that information to you, no problem at all. Okay. But sticking your hand in doesn't necessarily mean bottoming. We actually talked about that.
Okay.
There was people like yourself there in the regulatory limit that were fighting that, discussing it, like this.
Well,
yeah.
Stick my hand in, but really, again, it's your breathing zone, right?
So yeah.
Your face and things like that, because obviously in the brewing industry, you guys have heard about it, especially in wineries. People go on the top of tanks and they become overcome and they fall right in the tank. This happened. Has happened. If I raise your hand, have you guys ever heard about this happening? Right. So you open up the top, you're checking something out, all of a sudden you come over.
Poof.
And you fall right in, and then they're done. So then they've got the next shift guy sees them hanging out. Some of them fall in the tank. So obviously it depends on where the entry is, if it's on top, if it's on the side, if it's going in like this. But most of the time, I like to be careful when I answer your questions because I can't tell you it's yes and no, a black and white answer.
Okay.
I have to see a picture, understand the process a little bit. You guys have a very unique thing to do. Please keep doing it. It'd be very good.
Okay.
So anyway.
We're going to need to wrap it up. You're getting a gentleman. Feel free to come down and ask a question. So, Gabe,
thank you
very much.